Hello, I'm David Hughes, and this is Rogue Commentary, a new podcast featuring audio commentaries for interesting movies by the people who made them. On this episode, I'm really excited to have an exclusive commentary by director John Hyams for his nail-biting 2020 suspense thriller, Alone. I absolutely loved the film, based loosely on the 2011 Swedish film Gone, and when I heard that leading actress Jules Wilcox broke her ankle on one of the first days of shooting this very physical and arduous chase movie, I couldn't wait to hear how the hell John and his cast and crew managed to continue filming and finish the film. As always, you can listen like this as a podcast or cue it up to the film, pausing not on the logos, but on the first frame of the film itself. Ready to play? 3, 2, 1, play.
This is John Hyams. I am here to talk about our film Alone. And here you're looking at the actress Jules Wilcox in the city of Portland, Oregon. Portland was a choice that we made very early on that we wanted to shoot in the Pacific Northwest, and it was between Washington State and Oregon. And after some time just deliberating between the landscape opportunities, we went with Portland. It's the rare case where our decision to shoot in a place was not driven by tax credits or anything of that sort. It was a decision to shoot in a particular location because of what that location offered. We wanted a landscape that was very much a character in the movie. This character is going to find herself out in the wilderness, surrounded by trees and thick kind of rainforest trees with moss and trees that reach up to the sky, and something that the character is completely dwarfed by these surroundings. So Portland seemed like the perfect place for this. I should talk about Jules Wilcox first and foremost, because this character and this role is really the centerpiece of the film. Of course, it's essentially a two-hander. It's the character of Jessica and the character of the man. And Jules is someone that I had worked with once before on an episode of television. We spent one day shooting together, and in that one day, she made an incredible impression. And I felt like after that, I have to find a way to work with this person again. And when this movie came along, that seemed like the right opportunity. The scene that we shot for this TV show was a police procedural show, and she was supposed to be the victim of a violent crime. We spent one day shooting in on a hospital set, and in that particular day of shooting, as is typical in television, we had, I think, 4 scenes to shoot. Each one more emotional than the preceding one. It was. She literally had to be put through the ringer and wheeled into the hospital in scene number 1, crying her eyes out in agony. The next scene, she has to recount the brutal details of this crime. I think the third scene, she has to she sits with her sister and realizes that she's going to face a life of damage because of these awful things that happened to her. And then she's reunited with her young daughter and has to have another good cry. We shot the entire day, and she nailed it every single take, every time. And it's not easy with lots of dialogue. And you know, in TV, you really have to be a very skilled actor. You've got to hit those marks. You have to be able to deliver expositional dialogue. And she did it flawlessly every time. I was incredibly impressed. She's a theater-trained actress, and the skill was very obvious. We're setting up our very last shot when the camera department informed me that we had lost everything we'd shot that day. Somehow the card had mysteriously erased itself. It was a very rare thing, and I might add an incredibly professional, excellent crew, but these things happen. And so I had to step back in there and around 11 p.m. inform Jules that we were going to start the entire day all over and shoot all these scenes again. And she took a beat, I think laughed a little, and proceeded to do every single scene again, hitting the emotional beats every single time. And as you can see from this movie, it is a very grueling, endeavor for any actor. It's physically and emotionally grueling. And Jules was the perfect person for the job. And I was thrilled when the producers and everyone agreed to bring her on board. So here we are on the road just outside of Portland. And Estacada, I think maybe this town is called. And one of the things that I loved about Mattias Olsson's script that immediately drew me to this project was that it doesn't waste any time to get right into the story. And the story is something that is not explained to you. It's something you experience. And his script was the most stripped down, lean, tense thriller I'd ever read. You know, most scripts that you read are really spend most of their effort trying to come up with a really exciting, clever kind of plot. And this one came up with an incredibly simple plot and spent its energy on these kind of Hitchcocky, real-time suspense scenarios, one after another after another. And after reading that script, I just felt this is exactly the test I wanted to take as a filmmaker. This is the challenge I want to see if I can make something that is able to maintain the tension for the viewer. There we go. That was the first kind of near miss with the 18-wheeler with the logging truck. And to give a little history on this, again, I talk about Mattias Olsson's script. I talk about how I received that. This movie was made in Sweden by Mattias and our producer Henrik Axelsson, and another one of our producers, Mike McCary, had found this IP. His specialty is really in finding great films overseas and doing domestic United States remakes, or English-speaking remakes, I should say. The Ring was one he was famous for pulling off. So Mike McCary came to me with this, and I met with Henrik as well as Mattias, and we talked a lot about it, and I really loved the script. I had not even seen or heard of their original movie, which was called Gone, I think would be the English translation, and that's what their script was titled, Gone. I remember sitting down and telling them that I loved the first 50 pages. I was completely riveted. I thought the writing was fantastic. I couldn't believe that the writer, English was his second language. It was so well done. And the character was intelligent and didn't fall for, you know, the typical traps that movie characters fall for. She was a very real three-dimensional person, despite the lack of kind of backstory and exposition. Again, things that I'm tend to be allergic to, and I love that this script honored that. My discussion with them was about the idea that their original film went in a little bit of a different direction in the second half, in the sense that there was a whole other character that came into Jessica's orbit. It was a character of a park ranger, and it goes from being sort of Jessica against this man to Jessica and the park ranger trying to avoid this man. My feeling was, I understand if you guys don't want to change the story, but I'm really, really fascinated by this. I would love to be a part of it, but I think there's something more interesting that can be mined from this if we eliminate that character altogether and really keep it as a two-hander, which at a certain point then becomes a three-hander when Anthony Held's character of Robert enters the picture. Fortunately, they were willing to go down this road, and they were willing to change that element of the story, and I'm thrilled that they did. I think that it's really an interesting thing to watch the original, which I've only seen one time. I watched it that first time after talking to Henrik and Matthias. And then I decided, okay, I'm not going to watch this again, because it wasn't the movie that made me, that grabbed my interest for this project. It was the script. And my intention is to make what is on the page here and make this script. And the final product is quite faithful to Matthias's script. You know, there are plenty of cases, certainly with the work I'm doing now in a series, Black Summer, which is a show I do for Netflix, we take a lot of liberties with the script. I mean, my general philosophy is that the script is really a jumping off point, but you really start to find the movie when you're there with the actors and you're there in the environment, and that I never want to be too locked in. That being said, this script really, I think the essence of it is what is really there in the finished product is what Matthias wrote. There was some years between the time I met with them and actually getting it made, and in those intervening years I'd gotten involved in television quite a bit, and I was seeing that was kind of the world I wanted to get into, was the long form. That was where the stories that I'm interested in were being told. Then I had a great opportunity to make a feature film with some close friends of mine, actor Michael Kelly, the writer Tim Brady, and we made this movie All Square, which was a kind of dramatic comedy, kind of in the vein of a Michael Ritchie film, or maybe Hal Ashby. That's someone we were thinking about when we did it. But that movie was made with these two companies, Paperclip and Milhouse. Milhouse, which is Jonathan Rosenthal and Jordan Foley, and Paperclip, which is Yardley Smith's company with Ben Cornwell. And we all had a great experience working together. Yardley's a wonderful person, Ben as well, and Johnny and Jordan and Nick Smith. These were really hardworking, scrappy young producers who were, I mean, literally driving the art trucks to and from the set, and they really knew how to squeeze everything out of a low budget like that. And you know, we had a great experience shooting that in the summer in Baltimore, and they came to me and said, do you have anything you want to do? We want to do something in the fall. And I immediately thought of Matthias's script. I hadn't been involved in years, but it was always the one that got away for me. And I called up Mike McCary. I asked him if anything was happening. He said, well, you know, we'd been with another director for a while, but nothing's going. And And I said, listen, there's no money to be made here, but we can make this movie, you know, and if Matthias and Henrik and you want to see it made, this is these are good people we're doing it with, and we can get it made and make it well, and make the one that we always imagined. I was thrilled that Mike and Matthias and Henrik went along with it, because again, it was really just wanting to see this film made in the vision that we had had for it. And so that's kind of how it came together, was partnering these two kind of, or these several groups of producers and pulling it together. And then it becomes about, okay, what's the team we're assembling? Because that's what making a movie is. And that's what, to me, directing a movie is it's really about putting a team together, putting this group together that is going to realize this vision in a way that's beyond what you could have imagined. That's better, quite frankly, than your best ideas. And that's what led me to make my first phone call to Federico Verardi, who is the DP of this, and who I think is really just not only an incredible talent, but really is responsible for how this movie turned out and all the good things about it. I think the most responsible for that are Federico, who I'd worked with on some episodic TV, you know, the other two key collaborators in this were Nima Fakrara, who is our composer, and Samuel Nakach, who is our one-man sound team. Because this movie was going to be very spare musically, but tastefully so. And we had this idea that we wanted the sound and the music to be almost the one department, you know. And I have a normal sound team that I work with all the time, in Neil Fazzari and John Moros, but we were busy at the time. They were working on my show. So in this case, I asked Nima, I said, can you recommend somebody? Because this is, you guys are almost going to be the same department here. And Sam was the guy that he recommended. And I never before have worked with a post sound team that was literally one man. He did the dialogue, effects, edit. He did the premix and he did the mix. He did the whole thing. And it was incredibly impressive. And I think the sound, the work he did was outstanding. Like Sam, I would go back to Federico and the visual approach for this film. If you look right here, these tight eyeline close-ups, we talked a lot about doing these kind of Jonathan Demme tight eyeline close-ups. Again, there's something very disconcerting about them, but also something very subjective. You're literally in the middle of the conversation. You're not over the shoulder. Beyond that, the real approach was about how do we shoot this movie? You know, the instinct when you're doing budgets like these is sometimes to take on a very fast and loose kind of cinema verite, go handheld cameras. And that can be really effective. But I know Fetty and I both, and I know it's definitely Fetty's instinct to have it have a much more of a heavy weighted down lockdown feel, to have the images very composed, to be very sparing with our movement. I mean, I remember watching Fincher movies, and we would say, well, let's move the camera the way Fincher does, and that his camera's always motivated by the movement of the characters. It's always motivated by the movement of the subject. It doesn't really, certainly the more recent Fincher stuff, it's less about the camera as this kind of omnipotent thing that moves around like a Gaspar Noé camera. It's really tied to the subject. And here, this particular scene in the rest stop is probably one of my favorite scenes photographically, because I love, A, the way Fetty lit this. We couldn't afford and had no intentions of using condors or things like that, but we wanted to create pools of light and shadow and little spots of light that would recede in the distance. So Fetty kind of lit it with these lampposts. He actually brought these lampposts in. I think there was a handful at the rest stop, but he brought these lights in. And again, the camera moves, in this case, with the background character while keeping our foreground character, you know, always in the frame. We're always seeing things over her shoulder, and we're always with her perspective, until at a certain point we actually will then share the perspective. But it's really not until the final act of the movie that the point of view moves from Jessica and becomes hers and the man's to share, that we will switch. We will literally move where the camera is shooting from. To me, sometimes point of view is that simple, is where is the camera? Who's it closer to? And again, this shot being on dolly track versus something that's kind of faster moving on Steadicam or something. And here's an interesting thing that you'll see right here. She's going to stand up and start walking, and in fact, that is not Jules Wilcox. That is her stunt double, Michelle Damas. And the story behind that, the first week of shooting on this movie was everything that was on the road. It's funny, this shot is raining. I remember it started raining during this shot, and we decided to wait for the rain to stop, and we shot it again. And then when we were in the cutting room, we decided, Scott Roon and myself, that we actually liked it better in the rain. Somehow it was better, even though it wasn't raining in the previous shot. And sometimes you make those calls. Well, not sometimes. You basically constantly make those calls. You're constantly deciding on something that emotionally feels right versus what is right continuity wise. You know, continuity, with all love and respect to all the script supervisors I've worked with, but there's continuity on set, and then there's editorial continuity, and being a slave to continuity, I think, is a huge mistake, because you can get away with so much. It's not really about getting away with it. It's that the audience isn't aware. You always have to imagine, what is the audience concentrating on? What part of the frame are they concentrating on? How many, if now two shots later, you know, do you even remember what happened two shots ago, three shots ago? It's an experience that's moving through time. So being held down to the continuity of a given spot or location is not important. And that's, I always think about Martin Scorsese. I always think about Spider getting shot by Joe Pesci's character. If you watch the scene where Spider gets shot and killed, he tells Tommy to go fuck himself, and he's standing behind the bar, and then Tommy pulls out the gun and fires three shots, or however many, and he shoots him, and he's in front of the bar and gets shot several times and goes down and dies. Now, when you see that movie, I mean, it probably isn't until the 10th time that I saw it that I even realized that. Because the emotion of the, you're caught up in the emotions of that moment. And that's what should drive your editorial choices, not what hand they're holding the glass of water or the cigarette. If you watch the scene and everyone is distracted by the hair that fell in someone's face in one shot and not in the other, okay. If it's distracting the audience, then you adjust. But you first should find out if the audience notices, because you should not be driven by continuity when you're cutting. Anyway, back to the idea that was Jules' stunt double. The first week of shooting was everything on the road. And then we shot, then we went to the woods, which the better part of this story takes place. And in the first scene, one of the first setups, Jules had to run from one place to another in the woods in what we thought was a cleared path. And she went down. We didn't know what happened. And turned out she had tripped on a root. And turned out she'd broken her foot on one of the first days of work, of real physical work. And so we had to kind of take a beat and assess the situation. And as I say, this didn't look good, that we had a lot of physical work up ahead. The rest of the shoot was going to be Jules climbing rocks and running through thick brush and swimming in rivers or going down rapids and fights and all sorts of stuff. Producers came to me during the day we were continuing to shoot, and they said, well, we spoke to the insurance company and we can get it all back. They're going to cover us. I was happy to hear that for the investors, but they said, you know, when everyone's healed up, we'll come back out, we'll finish. But part of me felt like, I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, these things have a momentum of their own. And when that momentum stops, it usually means it's over. You kind of don't want to let the train ever stop. I remember we still had to shoot the rest of the day, as Jules Gamely did. And then I drove her home after shooting. I think, in fact, I was driving that black Jeep, the black Cherokee. That was my responsibility to bring that to set every day. And I remember telling Jules about the insurance situation, that it was all covered, we could all go home. I was so sorry about what happened, but you know, maybe we'll be able to do it again when she's healed. And then I said, but if there's any part of you at all that wants to keep going, then we'll definitely make it work. We can make it work. And in fact, not only will we make it work, but the challenge is to make this the thing that makes the movie better, as all those moments of controlled chaos and uncontrolled chaos that happened during a production, you know, you have to commit yourself and your mind to the idea that this is going to actually improve the movie. And you have to be open to the idea that these are always going to happen, that that whatever you plan on happening is always going to change. You could draw an entire graphic novel and shoot it. It's not going to turn out to be that graphic novel. Something is going to be different. The elements are going to change. The actors you hire are going to have better ideas. The cinematographer is going to have a better idea. Maybe the craft service person has a better idea. It's always going to change. And you have to be committed whether or not it starts raining that day or whether or not you wanted clouds, you don't get them. You have to commit yourself to the idea that you're going to make it better. So that's what I told Jules. And her answer was quickly and unequivocally, oh, of course we have to keep going. And I thought, okay, then we'll make it work. So when we lead you, when we shoot you waist up from the front, it'll be Jules. When we follow, it'll be Michelle. When it's really wide, it'll be Michelle when she's sprinting. And so it really, they were incredible partners on this. Now, interestingly enough, the insurance company paid and agreed that we would shoot basically three fourths of the schedule. I think it was around 15 days, 3 weeks. Then we would take a break. Jules would heal up and we would shoot those final things that we knew we needed, that we needed her to be on two legs for and not a walking boot. And this was one of those things, all this stuff in the basement. Funny enough, it wasn't the big action scenes. It was these scenes that take place in this basement that required, you know, performance between two actors, and you couldn't be switching a stunt double in and out or a body double in the middle of these scenes. You had to play these scenes out. She needed to be able to move around that room. So this was one of the things that we shot later, the following year, basically. But during the shoot, yeah, Jules wore a boot the whole time. And it was kind of amazing that the Keith Cox and Alex Tirzeef, our stunt coordinator, would carry her from one spot to another, because we were always in difficult locations. Everything was always a tough spot. You know, we were never on solid ground. So they would literally have to carry Jules around and plop her down by the camera, and she'd have this big walking boot. We'd have to dress vines and leaves on it so you couldn't see it. And somehow it worked. You know, somehow no one would ever know. And in the process of that, when I say making the story better, well, she's barefoot here. So how are we going to make this more interesting than what we had? You know, originally in Matthias's script, she sustains a gunshot wound to the leg. That was supposed to happen somewhere almost in the third act of the movie, or second act at least. We're moving that up to the first act. And we thought, well, what's an injury that's going to be something that really taps into something primal and visceral with the audience? And, you know, that's always important. You know, we said, oh, well, she could roll her ankle and break her ankle just like the actor did. But somehow that wasn't as interesting as what we were hoping it could be. And that's where we went with the idea of her getting sustaining a puncture wound. Now, during this, I should probably talk about the great Mark Menchaca and how Mark came to be in this project. He's it was basically through a mutual friend in Michael Kelly, who's a phenomenal actor himself, and they had both done David Simon's Generation Kill together for HBO. And Sari Knight was actually our casting director, was the one who mentioned Mark's name. And when she brought it up, I'd just been seeing him in Ozark. I'd seen him in Homeland. And I thought, that's a fantastic idea. Because for this character, you couldn't have someone who was too obviously a psychopath. And you couldn't have someone who could play the guy next door but couldn't play the psychopath. So we really needed someone who rode that line, who could, you know, in one light look like your neighbor and in another have real menace and be very physical. And that's what Mark is. You know, Mark is, he is a very physical guy. He's a Texas, you know, football player. He's also happens to be like the most fun guy you've ever met in your life. And he's just full of life and charisma, and he's the life of every party. And Mark was really going to be Jules's dance partner in this. You know, when you cast a romantic comedy, you're looking for chemistry. Well, we needed chemistry between these two here, and you look at them. I mean, this is a very intimate scene. It's a very heavy emotional experience for the actors to go through together. That's our producer, Jonathan Rosenthal, right there. And the chemistry between the man and Jessica and whoever was going to play them was critical. And you know, people have asked me before, what did you do? Did you keep them separated so that they were never around each other, so that you would kind of capture this reality when they're together and the fear would be real? And I'm sure some people do those kinds of things, and it's probably a great idea sometimes, but my feeling was I'm going to do the exact opposite. I want these two to become friends. I want them to trust each other. I want them to laugh. So immediately when Mark came to town, you know, we would all go out and, you know, and have beers and hang out together and get them to really just feel really comfortable with each other, which again is really easy because they are both incredibly, despite this movie and despite their characters, they're both incredibly fun people and lively people. And, you know, the two of them hit it off instantly and became total buds the whole time. And as a result, when you do scenes like this one, then they can take risks as actors because they trust each other. And so they don't have to protect themselves because they know they have each other's back. And I think Jules felt very safe with Mark. And that was important because he's gonna have to be a scary dude, and he's going to have to be physically engaged with her many times, and they have to go at it, and they really have to scrap in this movie. So you either could create a situation where they hate each other or create a situation where they love each other, and we chose the latter. And I think their performances are both outstanding, and I think it a great deal of it was the trust they had in one another. That's just really important for this. So, you know, after a scene like this, it doesn't mean we're instantly telling jokes after Jules is recounting the suicide of her husband, but we pretty much were keeping it pretty light. When the camera's cut, there's a lot of laughs, and I think that's probably something common on my sets, is that there generally is a very loose attitude, hopefully, and a lot of laughs, and people feeling very comfortable to be exactly who they are. And, you know, I, in many ways, I try to be the quietest voice on the set, really. I try to create a situation where everyone else is, feels like they are filmmakers and authors of what we're doing. They're not awaiting my direction. They have a really good idea of what they want to do. And I'm there just to kind of keep everyone in bounds, just between the lines. But hopefully those lines are wide, and that there's a lot of room for everyone to really do what they feel is right. You know, I often tell actors, certainly on my show and on this as well, that your character is your department. You're the department head of your character, of that department. Just like the DP is the head of the camera department, and so that your character is your responsibility. So if something in the script feels false, it's your responsibility to bring that up. Don't be nervous about bringing that up to me. You owe it to your character to bring it up. If everyone is thinking that way, not just the actors, but everyone in every single department, then you've got a lot of really smart people looking at all the logical ideas, all the just straight up creative ideas, and it's really being vetted by the whole crew every day. So these are not just, you know, decisions that the director makes on their own. I mean, they're welcome to, but certainly not the way that I go about it. I'm there to have an idea if no one else has a better one, but I really want everyone to take ownership of what we're doing. Now, this sequence in the basement is really close to what Matthias wrote. I mean, the nail that she has to pull out, wrapping the sweatshirt around the nail, putting the sweatshirt under the crack in the bottom of the door. I mean, it all just felt like, it felt smart to me, but not in a, she's not like a, some kind of master genius. She's just an intelligent person making intelligent decisions. And that's what I responded to so much in the writing of this character. And so that basement was in one kind of house. It wasn't really, that was actually in a house. And this was a totally different place. That's Michelle that we're following there. This was actually the day that Jules broke her foot. We shot outside for part of the day, and then we had to do this big sequence in the cabin. So we're staying on Michelle's back. We even shot the front coverage in this, but I preferred it in that one take there. I think is always more interesting. And this was, we built this little closet there. And Fetty got in there, and I love that sliver of light that he created, and the rest of it being completely black in there. I thought it was a great decision to not have any fill light at all in the closet, just to be just this little shape. And I love the way he, you know, short-sighted her there. You know, Fetty operated the camera as well. And this is kind of the scene that sold me on this movie in the first place. Was this whole scene of her in the closet and him out there, you know, making a sandwich basically, and then having this phone call with his wife and child. To me, that was what made that was all you needed to know who these characters are. And that they, you know, suddenly he became three-dimensional in his own way. And the rest of the movie really becomes this psychological cat and mouse between the two of these characters. And how do they use each other's weaknesses against each other? And I thought that that was just really intelligent in the way that Matthias had created these very interesting backstories that were not overly explained, but just enough to create a Achilles heel for each of these characters. And in fact, the, you know, when you use smartphones in movies, it's always such a bummer, quite frankly. You know, phone booths look so much cooler. But again, I thought Matthias had come up with great uses of how the cell phone or how the mobile phone plays in this movie, because it's obviously going to be a factor. And how is it used? And it's ultimately even used almost as a weapon and very tied into kind of the heroic finale of the film. And so that was really smart to me. This scene we covered, but we shot this long push in, and we did some cuts of the scene where we used only portions of it. But I thought, even when we were on set doing this shot, I really would love to play this all on her and just hearing him and play the duration of this long push in, and, you know, and Fetty putting just enough light on her, but not too much. That's really kind of, I think, the key is, and that's something that I love about Federico's lighting, is that he really steers clear of kind of dramatic, or let's say melodramatic, kind of baroque horror lighting. He there's a real softness to his light. It feels like he lights it like it's a drama versus a very contrasty horror kind of lighting, and just the right amount of saturation. And I think he did such a nice job on this. So this scene in here, again, was shot on that day when Jules sustained her injury. And coming up, once she exits here, will be the beginning of that day. So Jules at this moment in that closet has an untreated broken foot that's basically has an ACE bandage wrapped around it. Now you're going to see when she rushes out of this closet, that's Michelle. Now that was Jules. That was the first shot we did with Jules prior to the foot. And now right here, this shot, this long lens one, that was where she went down. So it was literally that one run. Her feet are not even in the shot. And as you can see from Mark, the way he runs like an athlete, you know, and he runs like a football player. And that was, suddenly you're now seeing this guy what she's up against. I mean, obviously he's already abducted her and these things are going on, but okay, now when we came back for the reshoots, this is where we did this, and that was a great piece of prosthetic makeup. I don't actually recall who created that, but it was Morgan Muda was our makeup head of our makeup department, and I know that our producers found someone to create that prosthetic. It was a I thought a really good one. So now this is part of the reshoots. Now this is part of the original shoot. And yeah, here Jules, now she's in a walking boot during all of this. We're just not seeing below her ankle. So again, frontal and not with a lot of movement. We got Jules, and now there's Michelle. So it's this was kind of the dance we had to do every day, which was keeping the two of them. But now we've got the limp is now factored in. So she can be injured. This whole river thing was really an interesting challenge, especially to do on a budget like this, because really, you know, safety becomes a major factor in these things. And you know, when you're young and you're doing guerrilla filmmaking, you take a lot of risks that at a certain point you think, okay, we got away with that, but that's not the way we can really repeatedly conduct ourselves. And we're doing union shoots, and we're trying to take care of everyone. We're not a bunch of kids running around with a camera. So these were some heavy rapids. This was November in Portland. It's real cold. And that's Michelle in that water. And there, Fetty operated this drone shot where we could really see just the rough water she was dealing with there. And that was pretty much what, you know, what you see is what happened. She just had to go down that river and did it probably four times. We had water safety people nearby. In fact, we had to paint one of them out of this shot digitally. And the close-up stuff was with Jules. We were right by the water's edge, and we were all in there. Even Jonathan Rosenthal, our producer, who's formerly a San Diego surfer, felt quite fine operating the camera going down those rapids himself. So one of those kind of POV shots going in the rapids was actually operated by Johnny. And the use of these aerial drone shots, again, a tool that I think gets misused and abused, but is a phenomenal tool when used right. And I think Fetty and I talked a lot about that. It was important at times to get above the action so that you could see what she's up against in the landscape. So it was kind of around these act breaks that we would do, where the you know, as you can see, the movie is broken down into these acts with titles. We felt like every time you came into a new act, it was an opportunity to kind of rise above the tree line and see exactly what she's up against, and that the landscape, as we say, is a character in the movie, and it very much is. And you want it to be beautiful, and you want it to be hostile and threatening all at the same time. A thing about those chapter cards, which is kind of an interesting thing. Originally, there were breaks. Those five breaks occurred, but it was really just about kind of going to black and then, you know, fading in from black, or, you know, cutting in from black. So the thing had these natural kind of act breaks. It felt like it was a five act break. Because this shoot spread out over a long period of time, you know, because we had to heal up in the process, I was off shooting my show Black Summer. I'd created a show and was off shooting it, and it was for Netflix. So it was a a binge series, an 8-episode series that was meant to be binge watched. And in trying to create that, I thought, well, how do I make this experience different than watching an hour of television at a time? How do I make it really completely designed for the binge experience? And myself and my partner, Carl Schaefer, on that, we came up with this idea of doing it in chapters, and that it should be like the book sitting at the edge of your bed, like a pulpy page turner that you can read a chapter, and you know, some chapters will be 5 pages and some will be 25 pages. But hopefully, by breaking it down into these smaller chunks, it almost keeps you engaged more than watching something in a full hour block. And I suddenly loved this idea of doing these chapter breaks. And then for Black Summer, I had the idea of doing all the chapters in real time. So that show is completely in real time, and that really created the aesthetic for the show. So by the time I was back to now editing this movie, because that's 2018, we shot the second part of the shoot for Alone, and then I was off to Canada to shoot Black Summer. And then during that time, Scott Roon was putting a cut together, but it really wasn't until I was done with the season of Black Summer in 2019 that I really could get around to editing this. And now I'm already in this kind of frame of mind of these chapter breaks, and we started to discuss, well, what if we create chapters that have titles and give it this kind of novel structure? And there was a lot of discussion about what those chapter titles should be. And I mean, I remember there was an early push by some that they felt like, well, it should be the stages of grief, because that is what this movie is about. It's about a woman who is grieving, and she's going through the stages, you know, anger, denial, bargaining, depression, acceptance. So that was kind of the first idea on the table, and I think we even threw those in for a cut. But I felt pretty strongly that the flaw with that idea was that the minute you put anger or denial up, you know what all the chapter titles are going to be, and you know exactly how many chapters there are going to be. So that already deprives the audience of surprise. And you never want to take that away from the audience. You never want the audience to know what's going to happen, even if they have a hunch about what's going to happen. So we said, how do we move away from being literal with these chapter titles, and how do we allow for them to create images in the mind of the audience that can drive them, that can pull them forward? Is something that I was doing in Black Summer, was you know making the chapter title something that maybe feels incongruous, like the title, you know, in this case, she wakes up in the basement, the chapter is titled The River. Now, why is that a river? Well, at the end of the chapter, she's going to jump into a river. So there's a payoff for that. And in thinking of it that way, we thought, why don't we keep these very basic, minimalistic chapter titles that at first glance are really just about a place or a location, but by the time when you get to the end and the final chapter, which is the clearing, then then the text and the subtext kind of come together. And then you have this where her inner life and the outer life have in some way come together. And the meaning is the same. So that's kind of how we arrived at those chapters. And I feel like it was a while before we got them right. It's interesting for a movie that is so specific in how it's shot and its coverage. There's not a lot of coverage, so there's not a lot of different ways to cut this movie. But still, you would be amazed that inside every movie, let's say inside every decent movie, is an infinite number of terrible movies. And that before it works, it doesn't work. And there's so many variations of it, however subtle they could be. There could be scenes that are directly, almost exactly the same in this cut as early cuts, but there were early cuts of this that people flat out did not respond to. And I really remember this from my years making documentaries, where you would have a cut of the movie and people just couldn't get with it. And then a couple of very minor, small adjustments, whether it was rearranging the order of something or eliminating something usually, and suddenly it's a completely different experience. And then it works. And so it's really, you always have to have that respect for what a fine line, as they say in Spinal Tap, there's a fine line between stupid and clever, right? And I think it's very true. You know, I remember watching Apocalypse Now Redux, which was the version where Coppola had added some of the scenes they'd cut out and had changed the order of some scenes. And I remember watching Redux and thinking, and I remember seeing it. I saw it in Lincoln Center in New York City. It was an incredibly beautiful print. And finally seeing the French plantation scene, the whole thing was remarkable. But I remember coming out of it saying, the cuts that they made were all the right cuts. None of those things that were in this version should have been in there. I remember one particular thing where it was the order in which the scenes played out, where Willard, that was what was really compromised in the Redux, was that Willard's character was no longer about, you know, never get off the boat, always stay on the boat. He, at one point in one of those scenes, he takes the guys and they get drunk and they solicit prostitutes. And, you know, it might have been an interesting idea for a scene, but it completely changed his character. I just remember the early cuts of this movie and those early decisions and early title cards and just some of the before the sound was in there. It really didn't work. It didn't work well at all. I do believe Sam's sound work and Nima's music. I mean, and I did always believe that this movie would never truly be what it was until the audio was completely filled out. Because, and this is the secret weapon of anyone who makes films or television, they all know that sound is not half of it. Sound is more than half of it. I firmly believe that picture is a third of the experience. So much of what you're experiencing, whether it is humor, tension, whatever, is generated by the audio. It's generated by the audio in the sense of words people are saying. It's generated by the music or the lack of music that's playing And then when you get into the details of sound design, you realize that everything in a movie from a sonic perspective is music. And that when you start to think about sound design that way, that you are literally creating a pulse and you're creating percussion and you're creating bass and you're creating all these things through natural sounds. And in fact, on this movie, we decided as Nima and Sam really were a single department, and that was the way we looked at it. And the way Nima created his score, which I thought was really just a very inspired idea, was taking sounds that were from the environment, sounds that Sam created, sounds from our production audio tracks, and he took those and looped them together and created musical soundscapes out of that. So that, I mean, literally the line between sound and music was completely blurred in this. And then, you know, and then there were those moments where we decided, okay, and now we need something that is going to be a more melodic piece, and that's what this calls for. And there are a few well-placed pieces that Nima did a beautiful job with. I mean, he's just an incredibly talented guy. He's a guy who like builds instruments. You know, you go to his studio there, and he's like creating instruments, and it's really it's pretty wild. He's just one of those mad scientist types. So the audioscape of this, when is the lightning, you know, when do you put sound to the lightning, the thunder during this, the rain, what's the level of the rain? I mean, though, every one of those, every one of those is a decision. And those are decisions that are made where you're watching, and okay, we want a delay between the thunder and lightning. Okay, now there's not a delay here. You know, you have to keep switching that up. And then here, now it's going to rain, and at a certain point, we need to bring the rain slowly out. And then he's gonna talk, because we don't want it to be raining during the talk, and that we were adamant about that. We turned the rain towers off during this because I wanted it to be very quiet. I wanted the rain to go away so that he didn't have to yell above it. So that suddenly it's almost like the rain gave her some protection. And then when the rain went away, then there was this intimacy. And she's, and you know, every little noise she makes, he can hear. And this was a fun scene to watch Mark, you know, do his thing. I especially loved doing this big wide master shot with him. And I was tempted to play the whole thing in this shot, but in the end I decided against that. But there was something very, it felt like theater. It felt like he was on this big stage. And Mark had this idea of the voice that he would use for the man. And it's a different voice when he's talking to his wife than when he's feeding his addiction here. It just, I think, kind of the way Mark looked at it is like, this is a guy who has an obsession, an addiction. So this is, he's feeding that. But then it, you know, then like any addiction, it kind of gets away from you at some point. So this, and this is something we always talked about, is that not only is this a really, you know, a really horrible, awful day for Jessica and the worst day of her life, but this is definitely the worst day in the man's life as well. I mean, he's facing everything's going to come crashing down if he doesn't find this person. So I think the pathos of that, his motivation was something that Mark dug into and played. He wasn't twirling his mustache here as a antagonist. He was playing the frustration of it, but also the thrill of this hunt. We had a little pool that we had dug up the ground and put the pool in so we could fill it with water. So Jules is out there in a wetsuit in that water. I got to tell you, this is maybe one of the colder nights of shooting I've had. And I've shot in Bulgaria in the winter. I've shot in Chicago and in the winter. I've shot in Calgary in the snow. All very cold experiences, but there's something about the Portland and the Northwest, because it's so damp, it somehow chills you to the bone. So those days where you're just, your feet are cold and you just can't get warm, in some ways is a very uncomfortable shoot for everybody. And that kind of is part of the fun of it, although I don't know that everyone would think that's fun, but the reality is nobody gets into this job and doing this job if they're not in it for the adventure of it. I mean, there's plenty of more sensible careers to follow. So if you're out there early in the morning on the film set, it's because you're a carny, you know, and you need the circus, and that's what we all are out there. We all choose this. We would all generally have it no other way. And when you look back on it, it's even the hardest days are some of the most fun, exhilarating days of your life. And it's truly an insane adventure every time out. That's why we do it. I mean, we do it because we love watching movies, but at a certain point, the appeal is to make them, you know. Once you're done making it, then you just want to make another one. It's really not about, it's about the process. And the process becomes what drives you. This is the desire to make another one. Not just to be on a set, but to kind of climb this creative mountain and start at the bottom and then get to the top. And then once you climb that mountain, then you need to climb another mountain. I love the night exterior lighting here by Fetty. And it's really one of the big challenges for a cinematographer. As my dad always told me, it's day interiors and night exteriors are the greatest test of a cinematographer, and my dad would know, being that he is one himself. And Fetty really, really understands the challenge of that you have you're simulating moonlight, but I've never been a fan of the kind of overly blue moonlight. I've also never been a fan of front lighting with that moonlight and over lighting the area. Even though moonlight in reality can be quite bright, it somehow doesn't ring true when you front light, and Fetty does such an elegant job of it. I always love this piece of music created by Nima for this. And the interesting thing was that it actually wasn't originally the piece for this sequence. And I remember Sam and Johnny, our producer, we were trying to find the right piece for this sequence. And there was some piece that had been created, this one here, and Johnny said, hey, how about that particular piece that we didn't use earlier? We thought it seemed like a good idea, and then the decision comes, okay, well, where do you place it? So we're like, all right, let's just throw it in there, rough it out, and see how it plays. And we're like, should it be here? Should it be when she opens her eyes? And then I thought, no, it was a very random decision. Let's put it somewhere around here where she starts moving forward. And we'll just see how it plays out. And as these shots and cuts progressed, it really just, as is very often the case, the rhythms of editing and the rhythms of music are very unconsciously connected, even if that music wasn't created for that particular piece. And you find it all the time. You lay a piece of music down and it somehow fits perfectly. And it seems unbelievable every time, but it happens so often. And this was a case where I don't think we ever moved this music one frame from the first time we placed it. We just put it there and let it play. I think we were actually in the final mix when we did it. And it kind of was playing over this, all these beats as they were. And then it comes to this, eventually this final moment. I love this location here with the moss-covered rocks. On the other side, if you turn the camera around, there'd be a parking lot. But it looks great looking straight at it. And then this musical piece ends just here where she hears the car. And it just coincided with that moment perfectly. It was just a serendipitous moment. Now, this is the part, except for a couple of shots, we are always with Jessica's point of view. When she exits the cabin, we do show the man's exit from the cabin. So we kind of play a dual point of view in that moment, and then we just stay with her point of view. Even in the previous scene where she's down in the water and he's talking, you're kind of with her more than you're with him. But I always felt like this particular sequence was a moment where his struggles were right there with her. So when he opens the hatchback of this Jeep, and now we're inside the Jeep, okay, now we're firmly in his point of view in this moment. Now we're, in a sense, intercutting perspectives, which I think, if done wrong, doesn't really ratchet up the tension. It just kind of diffuses the tension when you do too much intercutting of perspectives. You know, you sometimes want to sit with a character and experience it from them. And, you know, to use Black Summer again as an example, on that show, we have a single point of view in that show, where we never leave a character's perspective unless you actually see the camera physically move from one place to another. You never switch point of views. Here we thought, okay, this is a good time for it. We have him burying the body and we have her going to the car. We're certain that these two are going to collide at some point, and we're waiting for it. So part of suspense is leaning into the expectations of the audience and then withholding it for as long as you can. And that's that's always exciting when it's done right. By the way, that body that is in the grave, in the shallow grave, is not Anthony Held. That is one of our producers, Tom Zadra, who gamely put the wig on and crawled in the hole. We let them play out the scene, and we weren't sure how far Mark Menchaca was going to go in burying Tom. It actually became pretty humorous as the shot went on. I think Mark, if left to his own devices, would have completely buried him. We had to pull the ripcord at a certain point. I remember these were two completely different locations, where she is here and where he is there. Well, actually, that is the same, but where he's actually burying the bodies is a completely different spot. This was another one of my favorite scenes in Matthias's script, ones that really made me want to play this out. Not so much the fight in this car, which I think is exciting and is sort of our action climax, if you will, but just the idea of her in a closet. Well, I mean, it's really the three scenes: her in the closet while he's out there cutting meat and cheese and eating, her submerged in the water while he gives his speech, and then this one while she's actually in the back of the car while he's driving. In all those cases, that's kind of what a story like this, which is a cat and mouse thriller with two characters, is. How do you put these characters in close proximity to each other without one being aware of the other? How close can you put them together, and how many times, and how long do you hold these shots? You know, and I think if our edits changed on this movie at all from the first assembly to the final cut, most of it was letting these shots play, you know, and that's with a cut being a tension, a tension breaker. You kind of want to hang on to it as much as possible, or hold these shots. It's something I've always learned from the great Austrian filmmaker Michael Haneke, where he holds a shot in a way that at a certain point starts to become, almost starts to feel sadistic, like it's excruciating. You're waiting for this cut, and then the tension that he creates from this is incredibly provocative, and I've always was so impressed by all of his films, his ability to hold your attention. And it's not so easily done, because if you hold the shot for too long, you can lose the attention of the audience. So that's the balance you're looking for. And often you have to determine while you're on set. And I really think that's the discipline. And that's something that I feel like I've gotten better at and more confident with, and certainly spend more energy on, is taking the instincts I've developed in the cutting room and bringing them to the set, so that rather than shooting a bunch of things and saying, we're going to make those decisions in the cutting room, I find that the more you make those decisions on set, even if they're not always right, and even if you have to figure out ways to cut into your oneer somehow, it still is going to lead to a tighter final piece, and that is the discipline of filmmaking, I think, is that, I mean, obviously there's different ways of shooting, and they're all correct. I mean, you know, Tony Scott would set up eight cameras and shoot a scene, and Those are great scenes. But you also watch a scene like the ferry ride in Jaws. It's a single take. You know, we all know the Spielberg oneers are really some of the most impressive things he's done. It's not just the staging of, realistic dinosaurs chasing people. It's blocking in a very classical sense, actors in a space without cutting. This scene, by the way, we have Mark Menchaca with Michelle Damas in the background. I mean, sitting in the back seat. So it's Mark with a stunt double. Now you have Jules with Alex Tirzeef. And then you have Alex Tirzeef and Michelle in the backseat one. So we've got a combination of, stunt doubles together and then actors with stunt doubles all to create this sequence. And there, that shot, that car actually missed its ramp. I was the one who operated that first camera right as the thing starts to go off the road, and you could see that it misses its little ramp. And I was unwisely operating the camera that was closest to the vehicle. It gave me a nice close shave. When you're in the Pacific Northwest, you know it's going to rain. So we wanted it to rain, and we welcomed it, and we never fought it. But it was really kind of did us a favor here in the finale, where it really just dumped rain over these last several days. And we knew that would lead to a finale in the mud, which is really what we wanted. Once we saw that this was going down, we said, all right, let's really play into that. You know, you always hope that by the end, your characters have gone through a physical transformation as well as a, spiritual transformation. And in this, just by having Jules and Michelle, who did it in the wide shot, crawl right through the mud, we could start this process of having her almost go back to a completely primitive state. Mode Effects did that really nice helicopter. And we talked about, should it go right down the middle? And then, when you're doing visual effects, it's always about, well, no, let's make it like we didn't have a perfect composition. We set it up hoping the helicopter would go right down the middle, but it went a little bit to the right. And I'm constantly doing that with visual effects shots. How do we make it imperfect? How do we make it feel like the cameraman just missed it? Because when VFX are too perfect, they somehow stick out. They don't follow the rhythms of actual filmmaking, where, yes, sometimes you nail it, but sometimes you're just a little bit behind or just a little bit ahead. And it's important with VFX that they're not too perfect. All this stuff was shot on this property. This, obviously it's all about trees and logging up there in Oregon, and we needed a clearing, and I loved this kind of tree graveyard. I mean, we put a little bit of that smoke there, but a lot of that smoke was actually going because they burn these big piles of brush. We loved that it almost felt like a lunar landscape, that suddenly the entire movie there, she's kind of shrouded by the environment, and now she's moved literally into the clearing. And then this whole idea that Matthias had of this final phone call to the wife is a great cathartic moment for the audience. This is, you know, the idea is that the hunted becomes the hunter in the final chapter of this movie. And I love Jewel's performances here, her performance here. You know, she was able to finally release everything that was bottled up inside of her for this entire shoot. And I just, the day cooperated with us. We got that nice cloud layer. And again, Mark made a really great choice in all of this. He didn't play it with rage or anger. He almost played it. I mean, there was actually a tear coming out of his eye. He was sort of brokenhearted at this moment. I mean, and obviously he looks pretty pissed off, but it's hard when you're playing ostensibly a serial killer to bring humanity to the character. But that's what Mark completely commits. And I always find myself just smiling when I watch him in anything. He's someone I really hope I get another opportunity to work with like this, because he's just always unexpected. In this fight, obviously Michelle did a lot of this work here, but so did Jules. But Mark did every bit of it, and including every one of these hard falls where he's slamming to the ground and kicking his legs out. He did this entire fight himself, and it's a quick down and dirty fight, but it's a pretty exhausting thing, and you get a little banged up in the process. And I've done a number of very choreographed fights, and this one I did not want it to feel choreographed. I wanted it to feel messy and sloppy and just, you know, just rage, you know. And how do we set up a fight between her and him and make it feel fair? And that was kind of what informed the tire iron idea in the first place. Hey, let's give her a tire iron. I mean, that's a pretty good weapon for anyone. If you give a smaller person a tire iron, they got a shot. And then this ending here, again, the trust between these actors, it's intimate what they're doing and what they did in this whole thing. And I always knew from the time we were working on the script that I wanted to end it this way, with these dueling tight eyeline close-ups. I love that one of her. And then you hear the helicopter and you feel the rotor wash. There was some talk of shooting a helicopter, and I think in the script the final shot was looking up at the helicopter descending upon us, which is kind of cool, but I actually thought it would be more interesting to just end on her close-up. I always love to begin and end things in a real tight close-up. And this, you know, what better way to end this than on her face? And we actually did put a little reflection of a helicopter in her eyes there. And that's the movie. Looking at these credits, I'm reminded of Jared Briley, our first AD, and Jesse Bellis. But Jared Briley was another guy that I worked with on in TV, and he's just uh, He's a great guy and a great AD and a great cool presence on set. And I like that style. He's just very level-headed. And when you're working on these things, at a certain point, you start to realize that you're going to spend a lot of intimate time with these people. You want to put a team together of people that you just really like to be around. And that's how you're going to do good work, is when you're excited to go to work every day. So those people, that those key players that you bring in, I mean, of course their talent, their skill is a big part of it, but you're also fielding a team, and it's about your chemistry. Because if you have that, then the set kind of moves, and it moves in an effortless sort of way, so that no matter what is going on, no matter what kind of complication has arisen, if you're with the right people, you can, you know, really just sort of laugh and when something's not going right, and then quickly come up with a solution. Mark Todd Osborne, our colorist, I have to give him a mention, because I think he did All Square with us as well, and did this, and he just did a really really beautiful job of timing this movie, of really staying very true to the look that Fetty had set up. And it wasn't a lot of time spent tweaking and messing around. You know, I do find the more you do this, the more you, again, start working with the same people, the less time you have to spend deliberating on each thing. Somehow the process moves more smoothly in you, and you get to the answer quicker, and you don't have to kind of overthink it. And I feel like there's something, there is, you know, when you first start out, you kind of slave over every idea, and you question it, and you change it, and you change it a million times. And that is part of your learning process in becoming the filmmaker you're developing yourself to become. But after a while, you start to trust your instincts, for better or worse. You also accept that whether the final thing works out or not, there's an element of it that's out of your control. You have to just leave some things up to the gods.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another exclusive audio commentary. So please subscribe, rate us, and most importantly, tell your fellow film fans that Rogue Commentary is a thing. Follow us on Twitter for news about upcoming episodes. And if you have any suggestions for future contributors, email us at david@rogue-commentary.com. Bye!